The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 278, Great Movies That Have Expanded My Religious World. Panelists are Chrissy May, J. Frederick Voros, Martha Sontag Bradley, and Eloise Bell.
Oh, I can. Okay. All of us up here are champing at the bit, and some colleagues want their 2 and 10 and 50 cents worth of their favorite films. If you get a room full of movie buffs, this is what's going to happen. So we are going to start, and
I put the address, thank you.
thank you for the recorder. Oh, for the recorder. We're just going to start. There is no moderator, there is no umpire, no referee. We're just going to go in the order that we are listed in the program. This is titled Great Films That Have Expanded My Religious World. Welcome. Take it away. No, I'm the end. You're first.
This is my first ever appearance at Sunstone. By relation, I am here. I love shirts. Okay.
Where did you do that? You just pull that one out.
But for the this is
that.
How's that? That's good.
Good.
That's serious.
Good.
Real. I'm a big fan of popular culture. Some people think Hollywood is evil and corrupting, but in my family, Hollywood is what binds us together. Going to movies, having similar references, random movies that we saw 10 years ago, is the humor of my family. And I'm a graduate student in history, and my dissertation topic is California youth images and popular culture, which means I have an entire chapter devoted to comparing Rebel Without a Cause and Gidget, which they're essentially the same movie. I challenge you to watch them back to back. They are the same movie. And so I love movies, and the choices that have affected me most are pretty mainstream. In general, my cultural tastes are rather mainstream. And since I do study popular culture, I do think it has an effect on people and that people have an effect on it. And these are some of the movies that have affected me most of all. One movie, which you've all seen, but perhaps not seen in this light, It's a Wonderful Life, starring James Stewart and Donna Reed, 1946. It's a classic film, but in a gospel sense, it's quite compatible with a lot of Mormon doctrine. It's the story, you all know, of a man from a small town who never quite realizes his dreams, but at the same time, we're able to see the effect one person has on an entire town. And George Bailey, the James Stewart character, really represents the heroism of everyday life, I think. And his nemesis, Mr. Potter, represents how power and money can be corrupting and can take away your humanity. And the ultimate lesson of It's a Wonderful Life is that, of course, the worth of souls, and that no man is a failure who has friends. It's not money and it's not prestige. The other interesting thing about It's a Wonderful Life, although the angel has wings, and that's sort of the whole drive behind his coming to help James Stewart, and of course, that clashes a bit with Mormon theology, but the idea of angelic help and the idea that the prayers of the townspeople and his family has called on this angelic help, and that the power of prayer can help us, and that for all of us there will be a time of trial when there are many choices and when our faith will be tested, and perhaps we will not be driven to suicide like George Bailey was, but that we will be able to withstand our trials through the power of prayer. Another movie that really affected me, and maybe it was just because I was in love with Kevin Costner, I don't think that was it, but Field of Dreams, 1989. This is a film about baseball, of course, but it also does something that most American movies do not do, which is addresses the idea of the thinness of the veil between the people who are living and the people who have passed on. And Ray Kinsella is a not-too-successful farmer in Iowa who begins to hear voices, to hear the voice of a spirit in his cornfields. And this leads him to believe that he must build a baseball diamond in his cornfield. His wife is concerned, but she's very supportive, unlike other people whose husbands hear voices, such as Lehi. She's not a Sarai character in this movie. She's very supportive. She is influenced by the mysterious promptings as well and allows him to follow them. After the field is completed, the Chicago White Sox of 1919 appear on his baseball field, and they return in the form of spirits that only Ray and his family can see. And you don't really know why he's doing these things until the end. In helping these players come back and play baseball, he also helps an author realize a dream and helps a doctor realize his dream of playing in the major leagues. And in the end, I won't spoil it, but he saves himself. In serving other people, he saves himself. And I already mentioned the idea that this is one of the few movies that deals with sort of unexplained phenomenon and the thin line between heaven and earth. The other interesting thing I find about this movie is how it explores the idea of heaven and what heaven will be like. There's a memorable exchange in the film where one of the baseball players asks Ray, "Is this heaven?" And Ray says, "No, this is Iowa." But then later on in the film, as he looks at his wife and he looks at his daughter and he looks at his farmhouse, he says, "Maybe this is heaven, because heaven is the place where dreams come true." And Ray Kinsella's dreams come true because he follows the spirit, these mysterious promptings, despite the roadblocks, despite the threat of financial ruin. He follows the spirit and is rewarded. Okay, this film you probably haven't seen. It's one of my dad's favorites, and he argued that I should talk about it. And I watched it again. One of the things in my family he liked to do, we would have family meetings that he would make us watch Mel Brooks films. And we were 7 years old, and he's, you know, "Dad, I just don't get it." But this film, we did get. It's A Thousand Clowns. Oh, it's based on a Herb Gardner play that was performed on Broadway and has essentially the same cast in the film and sort of has a Broadway feel, but at the same time some interesting visual images too. It's the story of a few days in the life of New Yorker Murray Burns, who is a gifted satirist and a nonconformist, and he's faced with an important decision. Will he conform to society's rules and therefore keep his nephew, who he loves, or will he remain a nonconformist and lose custody as a jobless, aimless person? His approach to life, Murray Burns' approach to life, offers a good example of the use of humor in everyday life. Let me just give you a few examples from this film. You all have to go see it, but he's having a job interview. One of the problems the welfare board has with him is that he has no job. Because his fear is that jobs make every day feel the same. And one day he was on his way to a job. He was on the subway, and he couldn't remember if it was a Tuesday or a Thursday or a Wednesday. And that's when he decided to sort of drop out and quit. And he said, "You have to know your days and name them, or none of them belong to you, and they just go by." But because he wants to keep his nephew, he goes to a job interview in a rather dark restaurant, and the waiter comes up and he says, "What would you like, Mr. Burns?" And he says, "Well, a hamburger and a flashlight." Which I'm not very good at delivery, but it's very funny. He ignored the continuous request from the Child Welfare Board because, as he says, "I don't answer letters from large organizations." And he answers the phone, "Is this good news or money?" And if it's not either, he just simply hangs up. Another thing he likes to do is yell out his apartment window. He says, one of the things he yells at, "Neighbors, I'm sick and tired of the class of garbage I am seeing. I want to see more empty caviar cans and champagne glasses." Again, it's really funny. Yeah. Sorry. It's Jason Robards. If you ever seen him in the film, you know, he has the delivery. So this movie, as Murray must struggle with whether to rejoin society or to remain a nonconformist, it illuminates the pitfalls and the possibilities of being an oddball. I think in a lot of ways, most of us would want to consider ourselves unique, but there's a certain amount of obedience and towing the line and conforming that we all have to do in order to get along, and that is the struggle that Murray Burns has in this film. And in a sense, it's a comedy, but when you see it, it will keep you thinking long after the movie's over. The last film... Oh, and there's also a love interest. Actually, one of the welfare workers who comes to investigate the case sort of falls in love with Murray. Because you can't help but fall in love with Murray. And yet he's a rather frustrating fellow. Okay, the last film is a film called Peggy Sue Got Married. And it's another one of these time travel, mysterious, you never quite know what's going on. And in a sense, it sort of mirrors life. It's very unpredictable. When I first saw this film, you really have no idea where it's going. And it's the tale of a woman named Peggy Sue, who is newly separated from her husband of 20 years. And at the behest of her daughter, decides to attend her 20th high school reunion, dressed in her prom dress. She faints at this reunion and wakes up 20 years earlier giving blood in her senior year of high school. So she's back in high school, and yet she has all of the knowledge of an older person back in the high school body. And she decides she's going to change her life. She tries to break up with her boyfriend, who will be the husband that breaks her heart. She befriends the class nerd that she never would have done before. She also has... Maybe you see this on TV, it'll be better. She has a fling with the coolest member of the high school class, which she had always been intimidated by. But as a 38-year-old woman, she has very different standards and inhibitions.
Or lack thereof.
Or lack thereof, exactly. And one of the most moving things about this film to me is she comes back to her high school life, and she sees her kid sister, who had always annoyed her so much, and yet with the knowledge of the 20 years that have passed, she loves her kid sister. And there's another moving scene where she is given the opportunity to go visit her grandparents, who have been dead for several decades by this time. And it shows how we should value family here and now, that we should have a perspective that perhaps we're not valuing them now, but that we will in the future. Sort of that idea. Peggy Sue can't change her life, however, which is another interesting thing about this film. She tries to break up with her husband, but fails. And she tries to change the course of her life, and she doesn't, which raises the question of, even with knowledge of the future, would we make different decisions? Are we the same people? And another thing the movie has, which I require of any movie that I like, and that's a happy ending. So that gives you another. And of course, there are many other movies I could mention. Many films are memorable, and when we remember them, they become a part of us. And I think more than anything, movies can dramatize situations and help us learn things and give us perspective in our non-fictional lives that we lead.
The title of the panel is Great Movies That Have Expanded, I think it is, Enlarged My Religious World. Maybe I can just set that there. You know, I tend to view my entire life as religious, so it's a little bit hard for me to separate out the religious movies and those that are not. And when I first picked some movies, it turned out that none of them really were very religious, but they felt religious to me. So first I want to give you the list of the movies I didn't pick, okay, that I might have, but I didn't. Jesus of Nazareth, of course. the Gospel According to Zeffirelli. Saving Grace, The Magnificent Seven, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, Tender Mercies, Chariots of Fire, The Reavers, The Mission, The Hiding Place, Local Hero, and Smoke Signals. I want to plug Smoke Signals. It's in the theaters now. It's not overtly religious, but it's about reconciliation with one's father, which is a theme that resonates in our spiritual lives. It's really a wonderful little movie. It was a Sundance winner, and the cinematographer is actually a member of the church, and he was also the cinematographer in the first movie that I'm going to pick. Jesus of Nazareth. Maybe you better see if you like the ones I show first. Jesus of Nazareth, Saving Grace, Magnificent Seven, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, Tender Mercies, Chariots of Fire, The Reavers, The Mission, The Hiding Place, Local Hero, and Smoke Signals. You have to understand, some of these had a big effect on me, you know, when I was 16, and maybe wouldn't have the same effect today. This first movie I want to talk about, Radio Inside, I don't think I can claim was a great movie. In fact, I was just looking at the box of the video here, and it says, People Magazine Raves B+. For this tantalizing love story set against the colorful excitement of Miami Beach. This is a pretty good movie. Pretty great movie. Jeffrey Bell directed it, released in 1994. It's set in Miami, as it says. It does not have a religious theme, at least its major theme in the forefront. It's a love triangle. And two of the points of the triangle are brothers. And the third is Elizabeth Shue, who's really the only name actor in the movie. And again, the boy's father has died, and they are, one of them in particular, who's sort of a sensitive boy, is trying to work through that, and he ends up falling in love with his brother's girlfriend, is how it happens, Elizabeth Shue. But it's got a kind of magical realism to it in that this boy, this sort of introspective boy, has a fairly elaborated relationship with Jesus, whom he talks to by calling on the telephone from a payphone. And in one instance, the phone calls are not enough. He wants to really talk this out because he's got himself in a real mess because he's fallen in love with his brother's girlfriend and his brother doesn't yet know. So this scene is his talk with Jesus. I thought it would be easier to show clips than actually say anything insightful about the movie.
Life, except for Dad that one time. And now we want to fight for Natalie.
Well, I'm thinking of telling Michael how I feel.
Last time we spoke, you said you didn't want to do anything that might hurt him.
I still don't. But wouldn't it be better to tell him the truth than to have him find out by accident?
Have you spoken with Natalie about this?
No. But I think she really likes me.
And you're willing to risk losing Michael?
That's the question, isn't it?
What's the question?
Sorry I'm late. I've been dealing with work, and Natalie, I'm going insane.
You saw her?
She called me at work. I'm going to go over there tonight, and I think I'm finally being forgiven.
She invited you over?
I didn't know how much she meant to me until I nearly lost her.
It's just our name.
I think it's kind of an interesting film, even though it's a B plus, but it's a high B plus. Pardon me? Radio Inside. Yeah. The second film I picked, I think I can claim is a great movie, and that's A Man for All Seasons. Probably most, if not all of you, have seen that. A 1966 film by Fred Zinnemann. Won 6 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Screenplay, Best Director, Best Cinematography, and Best Costumes. It stars Paul Scofield as Thomas Moore, and also Robert Shaw, Leo McKern, Wendy Hiller, John Hurt, and Orson Welles, to name a few of the better-known actors in it. And it's a dramatization of the well-known story of Thomas More's crisis of conscience when he refuses to accede to Henry VIII's divorce of his Spanish wife, Catherine. And it depicts the events leading up ultimately to Thomas More's beheading. It's not an unflawed film. Probably its greatest failing is that it shows none of More's flaws. But still, it's parable-like in the sense that it illustrates a principle, and the principle being that you stand by your convictions, because if you don't, you have lost yourself. You no longer are who you are anymore. Also, I have to say that in the wake of the Purge in 1993, it took on new significance for me, although I loved it when it first came out in 1966. But the concept of being called in and questioned and so forth, having all your friends doing the thing, and why can't you do it? Why can't you just come along for fellowship and so forth? And the fear that everyone in the community feels in the face of standing up to a great power made it sort of doubly resonant for me. In this scene, Cromwell, who's sort of the hatchet man for the king, and two other people, a religious leader, I don't know what he is, a bishop or something, and the new chancellor, who is Norfolk, who's actually Thomas More's friend, are questioning him.
Of those who swamped it.
I have, as you say, seen it before.
Will you swear it? No. Thomas, we must know Clack. We must know plainly whether you recognize the offspring of Queen Anne as heirs to the throne.
The king in Parliament tells me that they are. Of course I recognize them.
And will he swear that you do?
Yes.
Then why won't he swear to the act?
Because there is more than that in the act.
Just so. Sir Thomas, it states in the preamble that the king's former marriage to the Lady Catherine was unlawful, she being his brother's widow, and the Pope having no authority to sanction it. Is that what you deny? Is that what you dispute? Is that what you are not sure of?
Thomas, you insult His Majesty and Council in the person of the Lord Archbishop.
I insult no one. I will not take the oath. I will not tell you why I will not.
Then your reasons must be treasonable.
Not must be, maybe.
Oh, it's a fair assumption.
The law requires more than an assumption. The law requires a fact.
Well, of course, I cannot judge your legal standing in the case, but until I know the ground of your objections, I can only guess your spiritual standing, too.
If you're willing to guess that, your grace, it should be small matter to guess my objection.
Then you do have objection to the act. Well, we know that, Cromwell.
No, my lord, you don't. You may suppose I have objections. All you know is that I will not swear to it, for which you cannot lawfully harm me further. That if you were right in supposing me to have objections, and right again in supposing my objections to be treasonable, the law would let you cut my head off.
Oh, yes.
Oh, well done, Sir Thomas. I've been trying to make that clear to His Grace for some time.
Oh, confound all this. I'm not a scholar. I don't know whether the marriage was lawful or not, but damn it, Thomas, look at these names. Why can't you do as I did and come with us for fellowship?
And when we die, and you are sent to heaven for doing your conscience, and I am sent to hell for not doing mine, will you come with me for fellowship?
So those of us whose names are there are damned, Sir Thomas?
I have no window to look into another man's conscience. I condemn no one.
Then the matter is capable of question.
Certainly.
But that you owe obedience to your king is not capable of question, so weigh a doubt against a certainty and sign.
Some men think the earth is round. Others think it flat. It is a matter capable of question. But if it is flat, will the king's command make it round? And if it is round, will the king's command flatten it? No, I will not sign.
My third choice isn't a movie as such. It's actually a miniseries, a BBC miniseries called Brideshead Revisited. But it is rentable at Blockbuster, and I sort of took that as my criterion for what I could talk about at this panel. It's a 1982 film, and it's based on a novel by Evelyn Waugh. The screenplay is actually written by John Mortimer. And it's a beautiful, beautiful film in every way, visually, thematically. The music is gorgeous. I should mention that it's probably, well, it's not probably, it would be R-rated. I mean, if you're thinking about renting these for family home evening, Man for All Seasons is G. Radio Inside's probably PG-13, that you see
yeah.
A brief glimpse of one of Elizabeth Shue's breasts.
Which one?
especially in the post-Titanic world, I'd say it's definitely a PG-13, nothing more. But Brideshead is R for one scene in it, a scene for which it's probably worth renting the six cassettes and watching them. But It's the story of... it's set in 1923, from 1923 to 1943. It's a story of a young man, 19 years old, agnostic artist, played by Jeremy Irons, and his entanglements with an aristocratic Catholic family, beginning with the second son, who's played by Anthony Andrews, whose name is Sebastian, in the film. It also stars Claire Bloom, John Gielgud, Laurence Olivier, so it's quite a cast in this one as well. And Jane Asher. I don't know if any of you have heard of her. Her main claim to fame is that she was Paul McCartney's girlfriend in the 1960s. She has a small part. The family, the Catholic family, there are four children, and two of them are very devout. The oldest and the youngest, the two middle, Sebastian describes as semi-heathen. And really it's about the spiritual journeys of these four children in the family and their parents and Jeremy Irons, Charles Ryder is his character's name, who also narrates the film from beginning to end. The first clip, I've got two short clips. The first, it opens in Oxford. It doesn't open in Oxford, but he meets Sebastian, Charles does, at Oxford, where they're both students in 1923. And Charles is very much in the background. Sebastian is someone everyone on campus, if that's a word you can use in Oxford, knows. And they meet in a very funny way that I don't have time to go into. But as an apology for the way they've met, Sebastian invites Charles to his rooms for a lunch. And this is that scene. The one thing you do need to know is that Aloysius is Sebastian's teddy bear.
I went there uncertainly, for it was foreign ground, and there was a tiny, priggish, warning voice in my ear, which, in the tones of Collins, told me it was seemly to hold back. But I was in search of love in those days, and I went full of curiosity and a faint, unrecognized apprehension that here at last I should find that low door in the wall others I knew had found before me, which opened on an enclosed and enchanted garden which was somewhere, not overlooked by any window, in the heart of that gray city. Beastly scout has put Aloysius to bed.
which is probably just as well, since there won't be any plovers' eggs for him. You know, Hobson hates our wishes. I wish I had a scout like yours. It was perfectly sweet to me this morning, but some people might have been quite strict.
As each guest came into the room, he made first for the plumber's eggs, then noticed for Sebastian, and then myself, with a polite lack of curiosity which seemed to say, we should not dream of being so offensive as to suggest that you never met us before.
Plumber's eggs! First I've seen this year. Where'd you get them?
Mummy's having some rice. They always lay early for her.
With my preposterous tutor. He thought it very odd my leaving when I did. I told him I had to change for footer.
Come and sit down. We better have already eaten your eggs. You don't know Charles Ray.
When I have the most delicious feeling,
I was
going to. However, the husbandman.
What is?
My dear boy, the news that you finally lost your virginity. Perhaps I should say, mislaid it. For my own grand passion. Quite in shape.
What are you rattling on about, you appalling dingo?
If you're going to be horrid about my cosmopolitan upbringing, I shall tell how you borrowed 300 francs to spend a torrid night with that elderly drab in the 2K. It was a niggardly sum to pay for her trouble. And what a trouble.
Charles, don't look so serious.
You don't mean to say you let boy have a go at your duchess?
My affair with the Duchess of Vincennes was on an altogether higher plane than any of you probably always can conceive. Do you know what it was that cemented our love? We used the same coloured varnish for our toenails.
So that gives you one side of Sebastian. This next clip shows you a little bit of the other side of Sebastian. You can see why he calls himself a semi-heathen from that little scene. This one, I think, also illustrates the visual beauty of this film, this second clip. That is, Charles and Sebastian, have gone off to Venice to visit with Sebastian's father, who lives there with his mistress. And the two boys and the mistress and the guide have embarked on a tour of Venice to see the sights while Sebastian's father stays home. This Italian mistress makes the observation that Sebastian and Charles have what she calls a romantic friendship, and they very much do, and you can see the beginnings of that in that first clip.
Tourists. All doors were open to Carlo's little Venetian nobleman. with him and a guidebook. She came with us, flagging sometimes but never giving up. A neat, prosaic figure amid the immense splendors of the place. I had no religion. I was taken to church weekly and at school attended chapel daily. But as though in compensation, from the time I went to my public school, I was excused church on the holidays. The view implicit in my education was that the basic narrative of Christianity had long been exposed as a myth, and that opinion was now divided as to whether its ethical teaching was of present value, a division in which the main weight went against it. Religion was a hobby which some people professed and others did not. At the best, it was slightly ornamental. At the worst, it was the province of complexes and inhibitions, catchwords of the decade, and of the intolerance, hypocrisy, and sheer stupidity attributed to it for centuries. No one had ever suggested to me that these quaint observances expressed a coherent philosophical system and intransigent historical claims. Nor, had they done so, would I have been much interested. Except on family occasions, and then with derision. My mother, I think, was devout. It once seemed odd to me that she should have thought it her duty to leave my father and me and go off with an ambulance to Serbia to die of exhaustion in the snow in Bosnia. But I later recognized some such spirit in myself. Later, too, I have come to accept claims which then, in 1923, I never troubled to examine, and to accept the supernatural as the real. But I was aware of no such needs that summer. Days life kept pace with the gondola as we nosed through the side canals. On other days, with the speedboat bouncing over the lagoon in the speed of sunlit foam. Every morning after breakfast, Sebastian, Clara, and I would leave the palace by the street door and wander through a maze of bridges and squares and alleys of Florian's but coffin, and watch the grave crowds crossing and recrossing under the campanile. I was drowning in honey, stings.
Stingless, yeah. It's a film about grace, and it has a very different sensibility to what we're used to in the church. And in that sense, it may feel a little foreign to you, but if those clips appeal to you, I think it's something you might like. It is 12 hours. It demands something of the viewer, but you'll be richly rewarded, both in the beauty of it, which you can see, and also the grace-oriented spirituality of it, which you have to really see the whole thing to experience. That's all I have.
In the past, past few weeks since I've agreed to be on this panel, I've been particularly keyed into the number of lists that have appeared in various forms of newspapers or on television about the top 10 movies of either the year or of all times. My video store has a section that's called Academy Award Winners, and another called Cinema Cafe that I've been working through this past month, and my daughter says that as a theme group they all deal with infidelity. I'm not sure why it's called Cinema Cafe. It has the regular old distinctions, which I think are meaningless. What is a drama to me might be a comedy to you. And so it's always sort of interesting to try and figure out really what are the most important movies or what is the criteria that you're using. We have on our toilet at home a book called The Top 10 of Everything, and it includes a list of the top 10 money-making movies that include, of course, the Star Wars trilogy and Indiana Jones and Pretty Woman and a number of movies like that. And all of these lists in combination have caused me to reflect on what we as a culture, I think most of these lists are pulled together by movie critics, and I don't necessarily consider them my representatives in the same sense that I do my representatives in government. But these are the movies that we tend as a culture to say represent our best effort, either over a year or perhaps in a lifetime or maybe even in an actor's career. Some of them are spectacles. We seem to love to be impressed by what movie makers can do. Others are epics or grand dramas or sagas. Others we just simply love because of the actors who are in them. Anything with Raul Julia or Denzel Washington is fine with me. I've been thinking about this today and have talked with many of you about it, how much I can chart my life by the movies I've seen. Charade was my first movie that I made out with in seventh grade with a boy in. My first date movies, The Graduate and Camelot and Butch and the Sundance Kid, I'll never forget them because they were sort of marking points in my life. I remember in watching the clip from A Man for All Seasons that some of us gathered to watch that during Lovina Anderson's excommunication trial and how moving that was to all of us that night. I'm one of those people who loves to talk movies into the ground after we see them. In fact, my children will attest enthusiastically to the number of times we've gone to a movie and then as soon as we get back into the car, someone inevitably will beg me not to talk about the movie. My daughter Rachel, for example, said, "Mother, can't we just this once remember this movie?" I think of this as the Jerry Maguire syndrome. I think that movie begs you to talk about it. You can't just go see it and not talk about it. It makes us question the way we live our lives and to consider the fact that how we live our lives matters. I think I enjoy this discussion so much because repeatedly throughout my life I have been profoundly impacted by films. Film is formed from a combination of language and image and sound that has remarkable power, a potency that can move us in many ways, and it does this all simultaneously. Perhaps it leads less to the imagination than the written word, but a movie with its sheer force and the magnitude of its presentation can sweep us away and hold us suspended in time, in space, or in an idea like no other medium. I have many favorite movies, and particularly many favorite movie moments or best lines. I'm sure we all do. But I chose today to focus on those movies which have confirmed or impressed themselves on my moral sense. It's interesting that the three movies I chose, or the three films that I've chosen, are all based on true stories. Although they are stories about history, not documentaries, and therefore not literally true stories, perhaps this reflects my bias as a historian. But I think it also will illustrate my point about the power of film to move us to ponder more carefully and perhaps deeply our experience as human beings. They help us to imagine how it might have felt to experience these moments in time. I already knew the stories each of these movies told, but thought differently about the world and the stories and my position in the world because of this particular telling of the story. I realized again yesterday when I was talking to my friend Stan Christensen, because of our differences about the direction Sunstone should take, how deep my idealism about how communities run, how deeply my idealism runs in my own personal psyche. I believe that we can and in fact have a moral imperative to find better ways to live together in communities. And I also believe that it's not easy and that it requires of us oftentimes difficult choices and the willingness to accept unpredictable consequences. The first movie I've chosen to talk about, and it's not by any means my favorite movie or even I think a great movie, is Guilty by Suspicion. Guilty by Suspicion tells the story of a man, a movie producer in Hollywood named David Merrill, who was working in the 1940s and is called to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee about his own involvement in the Communist Party, if he knows any communists, if he can give them the names of any of his friends who he suspects are communists. When the film begins, it's clear that David Merrill has lived what I think is a really selfish life. He has been clearly absorbed by his work above the above family, and he is a party man. He travels. He's really lost a sense of his core values and what really matters. He thinks that the hearings are stupid, and that's why he refuses to hand over information. He's pretty belligerent about it, but it's not a moral decision. It's because he thinks the whole matter is just stupid. When he first does that, I think he does it out of arrogance rather than a matter of principle. He feels like a really big, he feels like a big shot, a really important and powerful man around town, and so therefore he seems to think the rules don't bind him in the way they do other people. But then the story portrays the cost of not going along with the government proceedings, the ways he's blacklisted and becomes out of work. He can't do what he loves. His family is hurt by slanderous remarks. His life pretty much goes down the tube. And eventually he gets to the point where he decides he has to go along. And he begins that very complicated procedure of self-justification or finding a way to rationalize making stupid decisions. And he convinces himself that it doesn't really matter after all, that if he can just begin working again, it'll be worth turning over the information. It'll be worth doing what they're asking him to do. The really climactic and dramatic scene that I should have thought to bring on video so you could see it, and I have to describe it and it won't be nearly as powerful, is in front of the Senate hearing. It's very chaotic, very noisy. The senators are shouting out questions and orders at Merrill to present information. They're accusing his friends, his wife, all of the people he really cares about of being traitors, of being communists, and a number of other things, immoral, adulterers, and all kinds of things. And the camera is moving really quickly from image to image, which I think enhances the sense of chaos and drama and the noise. You know, it's all jumbled. And then all of a sudden, the soundtrack drops out and it's silent. And everything around him starts to move in slow motion. And it's a sort of epiphany. It's really an important moment. It's certainly a mental clearing where everything changes for him. And I think it's the moment where he shifts from being a really stubborn, selfish man to a moral man. And he decides that he cannot do what they are screaming at him he must, which is turn evidence and save his own tail. And instead he refuses to do it, but this time he does it, he refuses because it's wrong to do it. And he makes a moral decision. And as far as we see in the film, it's his first that he does. When I saw that film, I was reminded of the really eloquent words of Lillian Hellman, who in her book about the same episode called Scoundrel Time, it was an autobiography, says, "I cannot and will not tailor my conscience to fit this year's fashions." And again, refusing to pass information based on a moral platform or on the principle of the thing. The films that most linger with me deal with these types of moral moments when men and women are forced to decide what they stand for and how much they're willing to risk to maintain them and remind us that it matters how we make those decisions. The second film is The Long Walk Home, and this details the story of the Alabama bus boycott And it stars, of all people, Whoopi Goldberg and Sissy Spacek. Whoopi's name in the film is Odessa, and she's a black maid in the home of a woman named Miriam Walker, who's played by Sissy. It tells two parallel stories, the story of the black maid and her family during the years of the bus boycott, the difficulty she has in getting to work, her sense of the importance of family and tradition and community, her personal sense of morality and compassion, her sense of the importance of even the smallest decisions that we make, that if you ride the bus, even if you're dead tired and you have bleeding blisters on your feet, it matters. We see the racism and the self-righteous economic and cultural elitism through the Walkers' interactions with Odessa in their home, where she is their servant and very much the other. In many ways, the film is about choices, about, again, the significance of each choice that we make, that they matter in often unpredictable ways. And there are two key scenes, there are lots of key scenes, but I'll describe two. Miriam Walker has been driving Odessa to work, picking her up in her old Woody station wagon, which is really classic, wearing these little beehive glasses that are so funny. And she justifies it by saying she's going to the market, which is nearby, instead of, you know, saying I'm picking her up because it's the right thing to do. And her husband, at the same time, is becoming more and more involved in the anti-black movement, and he finds out that she's doing this, and he's really, really bugged and confronts her. And there's this really interesting sort of body language thing going on. He sits her down on the bed, and he tells her that she will not do this anymore, that she'll get in line and start being a good 1950s housewife. And she decides, you know, she's not brave enough at that moment in time to say, heck with you, I'm doing what I want to do. And so that day, she calls Odessa on the phone, and she says, I can't come and pick you up. And it's a rainy day, a really bad rainy day, and Odessa has to walk, and she arrives really, really late and really tired. And she decides that, you know, she's just had enough, she can't work there anymore, and that she'll have to get a new job. Miriam fusses all around her, and she gets her a towel, and she dries her hair, and she's really solicitous to her. And the two of them sit across from one another on two sofas in the living room, and they engage in their first real conversation. And I think again, the body language is so important because they're sitting down on this equal level. There's not this leveling again. They're sitting across from one another as women. And it's so interesting that the first thing they start talking about is their children. And Miriam is really brave in this. She says, you know, you've been more a mother to my children than I am. You know, do you remember when Mary Catherine had the measles, and you're the one that stayed up with her during the night, or when this or that happened? And she's really acknowledging the fact that Odessa's given very generously of her heart. And Odessa said any mother would have done that. And Miriam says, well, I wonder if I would have done that for your children. And it's a real important moment of shifts, where both of them are starting to think differently about each other, and they're no longer afraid of each other, and the cultural boundaries that divide them seem to be pulled down. Miriam makes a really important decision out of that she will continue to drive Odessa to work, and in fact she becomes a participant in the carpool that's driving other black maids to their places of employment. In the final scene of the movie, and it's about the last 10 minutes in the scene, is so powerful, and you just bawl your way through it. I remember when I first saw it with a friend, I started bawling about 45 minutes before the end and continued to the end. So powerful. I've probably seen it 30 times. I show it to all my classes and cry every time I show it in front of my classes. It doesn't matter to me. But at the final scene, there's this group of white men who've decided they're going to put down the carpool. And so they go to this car lot, and they've got baseball bats, and they're going to beat the heck out of these black women to show them, you know, who's boss, and to put down the idea of the carpool. And it's surprising to Miriam's husband that she's one of the women there working it. And the black women at first are really intimidated by this show of force, but then they stand together in a line, and they kind of tentatively take hands and they begin to sing. It's so powerful because it shows you not only the strength of an individual but the collective strength when we join in a cause that is right and good. But the really important thing is when Miriam Walker crosses over the line and joins hands with them as well. And I think she realizes at that point in time, and Odessa has said this to her earlier, that once you cross that line, you can't ever go back. You know, and you can't predict what's going to happen to you then. But again, a really important reminder of the power of a moral individual. Just one more, and I'm pretty conscious of how short we are on time, but I really want to talk about Judgment at Nuremberg, which is one of my very favorite movies. It's really old and really old-fashioned in the way it's filmed. It's in black and white, and it takes 3.5 hours, almost 3 hours and 45 minutes to watch it, but every second of it is worth watching. The story takes place in Europe in the wake of World War II and the Holocaust, but the issues are issues that all communities must face. The film deals with a period of crisis and attempts to identify those parties who are culpable or responsible. The issue of responsibility is critical to coming to a sense of how we relate to each other in communities. How far can we go in excusing our behavior based on our backgrounds or environment, outside forces, or whatever? In this film, every one of the characters is really significant because they portray a different issue involved in this debate over culpability or corporate community responsibility. The opening statement, which is given by the defense attorney, who's played by Maximilian Schell, says that the answer to these trials will be found, after all, in the character of man. And I think that that kind of gives away the whole film. It's really the final conclusion of the film as well. He introduces the judges, introduces the core issues, and says that judges are important because they're role models. They introduce a number of characters, servants, for example, in the home that the chief judge, who was played by Spencer Tracy, where he is living, and the servants say, you know, he's questioning them about how much they knew, and they're really timid about even talking to him. They say, "We didn't know anything. We're just common people. We didn't have any power. We're not political. You know, we're not responsible because of those kinds of reasons." They go through a number of witnesses who were involved in a variety of situations during the Holocaust. One man was an individual who had been sterilized because he was mentally deficient, and he represents a sort of disposable type of person in our community that we can live without, that we value less because of certain reasons. A white German Aryan woman would probably be a better way of describing who has taken up a friendship with an older Jewish man, and that talked about the issue of racial pollution, and again how we identify certain pockets of our community as being dangerous or off limits or for whatever reason less than. And during all of this, the chief justice, the main judge, who's a man named Janik, sits there and he listens to all of it and he never moves. It's played by Burt Lancaster, I think. After they're just grilling Judy Garland, who plays this young woman, he stands up and he's just had enough of it. He thinks it's gone far enough, and he's a real man of honor. You really understand how much it costs him to stand up and do this. And he says, I need to testify now, and I want to read you some of his lines, not try and paraphrase them, because they're so powerful. He says, "Are we going to do this again? Don't we ever learn the lessons of history? And if we fail to act on them, then what does this mean about us as a people?" He said, "What I did because I wanted to leave the German people something." And he said, "We did this out of fear of our neighbors, of our families. There was a fever on the land." He said, "Hitler said he wanted us to be proud of Germans, and that once the devils were destroyed, we would be safe." And then he says, and this touches back on this issue of justification, he says, "What about those of us who knew better? Did we do it because we loved our country? We said it was only a passing stage, that our country was in danger, and then when it was over, we would go forward." And then he says, "And then one day we looked around us and we found that we were in a more dangerous position. What had been a passing phase had become a way of life." said, I was content to sit by and watch this trial until I realized that for him to win, he would have to raise the specter again. He says, once again it has been being done for love of country. It is not easy to tell the truth, but we must, regardless of the pain and humiliation. And in the final judgment upon the judges, Spencer Tracy makes this most eloquent statement about the significance of the decision and how difficult to judge one another, but that it's important that we do that as a measure of our own moral integrity. He said, and this is just one of those one-liners from a film that just stays with you forever. He says, a country is not a rock. And you can think of this in terms of a person, an individual is not a rock. It is an extension of self, and it is what is worth standing for when the standing is most difficult. He says of the judges, if they had been monsters, then the events wouldn't have had moral significance. But under a national crisis, ordinary and extraordinary men can find ways of justifying evil and how easily it can happen. A decision must be made in the life of every country or institution or religious organization or in every individual's life to survive. The verdict says this is what we stand for, justice, truth, and the value of a single human being. Just in terms of a conclusion, and this is a really hard thing to round up because these words themselves are so very eloquent. I have learned to sit through shows like Beverly Hills Ninja and Mr. Bean, and I've watched Ninja Turtles more times than I would like to admit publicly. But I grow more from films like Judgment at Nuremberg because they challenge me to think more deeply and carefully about the meaning of my life. And I'd like to conclude with a statement that my friend quoted at lunch when we were talking about favorite one-liners, and it comes from a Woody Allen movie called Hannah and Her Sisters, and it's made by the Max van Sydow character, if you remember. He said, if Jesus could see what we are doing, he would never stop throwing up. And I'm in complete agreement.
Time of day, they tell us, when our biorhythms tend to slump. So in recognition of anybody's biorhythms that might be slumping, I suggest we stand up, do head, shoulders, knees, and toes. And those of you who want to sneak out may do so. You see under cover of standing bodies and so forth. Yes.
So are you leaving,
Ellen? Am I leaving? Not for a moment.
Leading.
Not
leading.
Leading. Leading. Yeah. No. I would have a sweep. Anyone have a sweep? It was, as Fred was talking about Bride's Head Revisited and reminding us that it was, the script was by James Mortimer. I thought, isn't life marvelous? James Mortimer also wrote Rumpole of the Bailey. Thank God for diversity. And I did not know Radio Inside, but when he was talking about talking with Jesus, that made me think of a film that I wanted very much to talk about with you. And I saw it for a second time. I got the video, and I tried to get through it. It's a hard film for me to see. But it's a fine film. I'm not going to talk about it, but I recommend Breaking the Waves with Emily Watson. One of the most thought-provoking and religiously focused films I have seen. I couldn't manage it for this presentation, but I recommend it to you. Like most college professors, I'm conditioned to 50-minute presentations, and on subjects that really engage me, 50 minutes is hardly enough. To speak for 20 minutes on film seemed like a little jest that Elbert designed to teach me self-discipline and moderation. This is a Christmas ornament that Elbert gave some of us a few years ago. It's a sunstone. It's a Christmas ornament, but I decided to wear it. I have a little song that goes with it, but I won't go into it, but it goes like, Elbert wants me for a sunstone to read for him today. Anyway, but I won't do that either. Because of the great love I have for Elbert, I will try to make sure that my cup runneth not over. This session is currently called Great Movies That Have Expanded My Religious World. Let us not begin, at least, with Cecil B. DeMille rhetoric, but rather bear in mind Robert Frost's axiom, anything more than the truth would be too weak. Anything more than the truth would be too weak. Come to think of it, that's precisely the problem with nearly all of the biblical epics put on film, if you think about it. In any case, I'd like to downsize my segment and title it Excellent Movies That Have Expanded My Religious Insights. For this discussion, it's important to distinguish spiritual from religious insights. Every movie on my all-time favorites list is chock full of spiritual insights. Strangers in Good Company and Antonio's Line and all of the rest of them. Cinema Paradiso and Il Postino and all the rest of them. A friend said, any movie that adds to our understanding of the human condition has spiritual insights. There's a category of film that some people think of as specifically spiritual because it deals with the human being in serious conflict with the forces of evil, or because it treats good and evil seriously and thoughtfully. Often these films show us the human spirit triumphing over great odds, and you can think of a dozen such films in a single breath. The Inn of Sixth Happiness, Dead Man Walking, Elephant Man, Brian's Song, My Left Foot, Heartland, Rocky, Ben-Hur, Schindler's List, Miracle Worker, Shine, Sling Blade. Wonderful, powerful films about spirituality. For the purpose of this discussion, I'm going to define religious movies this way. A religious movie is a movie focused on religious insights that say something meaningful about organized religion or its interplay in human life. Just because a film is set in an Amish community or a Catholic convent or a Jewish shtetl, that does not make the film making a statement about religion per se, any more than a film set in Provo Canyon necessarily makes a statement about it. Most American-made films with religious settings do not, in fact, deal with religion in any appreciable way. I do not know why this is. I would think that in light of all the bloodshed over the years in the name of religion, it would be up there among the blockbuster topics. If not at the apex with sex and war, at least right up there close. But it isn't. In most films that have a religious coloration, we get one of three approaches, none of which gives serious insight about religion as such. Early on, religious films got the epic treatment. You know the great biblical epics in movies. The Ten Commandments, The King of Kings, Ben-Hur, Samson and Delilah, David and Jonathan. No, they haven't made that yet. David and Bathsheba. That's the one. The Big Fisherman, the Robe, the greatest story ever told. Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist Gary Trudeau made a statement about Titanic, the recent movie Titanic, that applies to these biblical epics also, said Trudeau about Titanic. The producers clearly spent so much money on sets and stunts and extras that there was nothing left to pay for a decent script. I am not dissing these films. I will watch Charlton Heston as Moses or as Ben-Hur every single year and be happy to do so. But none of the listed epics has expanded either my faith or my understanding of religion by so much as a mustard seed. Entertaining, yay. Enlightening, nay. During World War II, Hollywood couldn't fund the great epics much anymore, but turned instead to an approach that had already worked with other subjects, the sentimental mode. Audiences proved to be as sentimental about a black robe as they had been about Shirley Temple curls. In 1936, Spencer Tracy was enormously acclaimed as the tough-talking priest in San Francisco, receiving an Academy Award nomination for his work. 2 years later, he starred in Boys Town, and the picture got two Oscars. In 1941, he did Men of Boys Town, no Oscars. 1943, Jennifer Jones had to sweat pretty hard to get her black robe, but she got it, and the picture, The Song of Bernadette, earned four Oscars. Well, if one woman in a nun's outfit merits an Oscar, what about two men in priest robes? Sure enough, 1944's Going My Way collected six Oscars. Its sequel, Bells of St. Mary, received no award, but it did start Hollywood thinking about Ingrid Bergman's spirituality. and saintly qualities, and in 1948 she climbed into a suit of armor for St. Joan. This hallowed production received 8 Academy Award nominations, including one for Bergman as Best Actress. She did not take home the Oscar, but 3 of her co-workers did. Back to 1944, also donning a black robe that year was Gregory Peck in a film version of A.J. Cronin's The Keys of the Kingdom. In her review of that film, Pauline Kael says that Peck's saintliness comes across as a lack of imagination, utter sterility. Nonetheless, this movie earned 4 Oscar nominations, including one for Peck as Best Actor. After no Oscar. I never did like him. Once America got witch hunting out of the way, to which Michael referred, it was safe for a third approach to religion, the satiric. Now, I've had to cut about 3 pages here, but you would have enjoyed my wry analysis of some of the better religious satires, beginning with Elmer Gantry in 1960 and including Steve Martin's Leap of Faith in 1992. Bottom line, none of these satires said much that was enlightening about religion, and I must move along to discuss 3 films that do provide, for me, rich insight of a specifically religious time. Robert Duvall's film, The Apostle, went into distribution a bit too late to get the attention it deserved in 1997. How many have seen The Apostle? Good! Although Duvall himself was nominated for a Best Actor Oscar for his work in that film. The error of timing was bad because it's a great film. New York Times critic Janet Maslin praises The Apostle, calling it, quote, a rare display of spiritual light on screen. She's absolutely right about the rarity of the achievement, and she is right in identifying the spiritual light that radiates from the film. But it also shows us something important about religion as distinct from spirituality, or as more focused. Let's talk briefly about the rarity of Duvall's storyline. He not only acted in this, he wrote it and directed it. The apostle of the title is a Southern fundamentalist preacher named Sonny, a white man who got his call early in life in an African-American church. Now, most of us watching the film think we know the Sonnies of this world. Jim Baker, Jimmy Swaggart, Kenneth Copeland, Oral Roberts. We have seen them performing on television for years. We know the scandals associated with their careers. When we hear Sonny's fiery sermons, which are not nearly as restful as your average Mormon church talk. When we hear his sermons, and when we sense the great inner passion that drives Sonny, we're sure we know what kind of trouble he's headed for. It's easy to mistake Sonny's hell-bent for heaven energy for ego. You see, we think he's an egotist. But time and again in the film, the predictable doesn't happen. We think he's going to beat his wife, but he doesn't. We think he's going to force himself on a woman he's dating, but he doesn't. We're sure that sooner or later he's going to bamboozle one of his congregations. He doesn't. In the first half of the film, Sonny is so determined to have a church, so single-minded about his passion to find one, that we're convinced he's up to no good. What does he want with a church? It looks like he's so intent. It's our own myopia that misleads us. Sonny does not abuse the church, he uses it. And therein lies the fresh and powerful insight of the film. Sonny may have ego problems in his personal life, but in his work, in his calling, he is pure of heart, untainted by selfishness or personal agenda. He is a man of genuine spirituality and of considerable soul, but that's another topic. Because Sonny preaches in a style that has more salsa than most of us are used to in our worship service, we watch him with a trace of a smirk on our lips. The more fool we. Because, you see, Sonny knows what his church, a church, any church, is for. Is not the purpose of a church to be a tool? A tool for making the lives of people richer, happier, more buttressed by faith and love? Sonny wants a church, needs a church, in exactly the same way a carpenter needs a hammer. He is not a solo act, a one-man show. not a star who stumps the pulpit, passes the hat, and sits back to count the tape. And he is so far from being a church administrator that we cannot imagine him even giving room in his mouth for such an alien word. This quirky, self-baptized, self-ordained apostle knows how to forge a community of believers out of the curious and the stragglers who filter into the meeting house. And he knows how to generate within that community electric currents of love and belief. Nothing is beneath his dignity. No act is devoid of joy if it is serving his congregation. Sneaking up to a porch with a box of food for a poor family and getting away unidentified is high giggling sport. Painting a decaying old building and making it a tabernacle of the Lord becomes a festival for Sonny and his flock. Moviegoers in the first half of this century almost choked on a diet of syrupy and saccharine portrayals of organized religion. In the second 50 years, we've been fed dry, sour, or bitter satires of the church as a corrupt and constipated institution. Duval's apostle reminds us how joyously and powerfully the church thing works when it ain't broke. The Truman Show, starring Jim Carrey in his first role as an unmitigated human being, has been widely and enthusiastically praised. But I have yet to read a single review that treats the film's theme with the seriousness it deserves. New York Times critic Janet Maslin raves about the picture, but then faults its theme. She begins by quoting the character of Christoph, the director in the film, not of the film, or as he calls himself, the creator. Quote, now I'm quoting Maslin, who is quoting the character Christoph. "We accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that," intones Christoph. And then Maslin continues, "The story's central notions really are that simple, and in the end, they're too slender to sustain a film as ambitious as this," close quote. The New Yorker critic Anthony Lane writes, "The picture's doomy warning that television will overrun our lives and brains is not exactly original." To all of that, I say rubbish. The Truman Show central notions are no more slender than Milton's Paradise Lost. And very similar. As to original, they are better than that. They are archetypal. And no, Mr. Lane, the picture's warning is not about television, but something much grander. It is a warning about the aims and premises of religion. And it is a warning peculiarly relevant to Latter-day Saints. One need not stretch in the least to reach this conclusion. The basic allegory here is not even especially subtle. The director of the 30-year soap opera, which is Truman's life, is named Christoph, hint, hint. And he calls himself the creator. He has, in fact, created the entire world in which Truman lives. He directs every aspect of it. "Cue the sun," he says, and there is sun. When Christoph is ultimately challenged about the limitations he imposes on Truman, he rationalizes that those limitations are for the man's own good. The world outside is evil and dangerous. The world Christoph has made for his character, by contrast, is a haven, safe, clean, pleasant. It is important that we grant Christoph his genuine, if tragically misplaced, concern for Truman. More than concern, he actually feels a father's love for Truman. If you've seen the film, you remember he tenderly strokes televised images of the boy's hair. And Truman is a boy, despite his 30 years. The crew who televise his life wear t-shirts. Does anybody remember what the t-shirts say? "Love him, protect him." Have we heard this philosophy before, brothers and sisters? More to the point, do we hear it still and on every side? Forgive me the rhetorical questions. Yes, we have heard this philosophy before. In Mormon theology, we have an account of a premortal decision about how men and women would be saved. Satan proposed a foolproof method, a world so structured, so devoid of choice, that all would be saved. Christ's proposal, by contrast, called for personal freedom, a full range of choice, and the risks that accompany such freedom. We hear this philosophy still. Not only Mormonism, but many other religions as well seem to spawn a host of megalomaniacal Christophs. They would direct our lives, with love, of course, primarily by limiting the range of exploration, the questions that can be asked or pursued, the experiences that can be had. Truman, earlier in his life show, underwent a traumatic, though fake, loss at sea, which resulted in a lifelong fear of water. The phobia keeps him from leaving the island of Sea Haven. Observations show us many faithful followers of fundamentalist religions are so filled with fear of making a misstep that they tremble to take any step at all beyond the prescribed boundary. In the current Sunstone magazine, Levina Fielding Anderson, with her usual dexterity, puts her finger squarely on the problem in her essay, Loving the Questions. She tells us that after her excommunication, quote, the fear is gone, and with it the burdens of the rules, regulations, and restrictions. Was I afraid all those years that only a rule stood between me and moral chaos? How could I have had so little faith? End quote. The self-appointed Christophs, clearly fear-filled, would play